hear me. I'm switched on. My name is Jane Barnett, and I'd like to welcome those of you both in the auditorium and also listening to us live to this South Pacific Weather Training teleclass, which features Professor Kirsten. For those of you listening in via your telephone link, you should know that we are broadcasting live in front of an audience of approximately 300 people, plus a few stragglers coming through the door, at our annual New Zealand Infection Control Conference. Many of you will remember that we broadcast the inaugural lecture of this series last year in Christchurch, and I'd like to thank Maureen Rawson and her team for making it possible to do the same this year. We're actually at the wonderful centre of Te Papa, the museum and exhibition centre and, of course, conference centre here in the capital city of Wellington. For those of you in the audience here, you should know that you're being listened to by several thousand people, both live and on the rebroadcast. So those coughs and sneezes will be broadcast out worldwide. So make sure you use your cough and sneeze etiquette, please. Okay. Weather training education is made possible by the generous corporate sponsorship that it receives, and this session, as Maureen has indicated, has been kindly sponsored by Johnson & Johnson Medical New Zealand. On behalf of Paul Webber, please accept my thanks for that. I think Carmel and her team are hopefully in the audience somewhere, so thank you. Such support enables to make sure the education sessions are free for those in developing countries. Without further ado, let's move on to the lecture. Peter Kirsten has an impressive bio. He is, as Maureen has said, Professor of Medical Geography at Macquarie University. I've tried practicing that. I still can't pronounce it correctly. And also Professor of Population and Security in the Centre for International Security Studies at the University of Sydney. He is former Dean of Environmental and Life Sciences and Health and Head of the School of Earth Sciences at Macquarie, and also co-director of the Commonwealth-funded Climate Impact Centre. He's author of a number of books and also articles relating to public health and medical geography. Like I said, an impressive bio. Peter's originally from New Zealand, having been brought up in Auckland, and still supports the All Blacks, so once a Kiwi, always a Kiwi. So welcome back to New Zealand, Peter, and thank you very much for being our guest speaker today.
Thank you. It's always nice to come home. This address was originally given to a communicable diseases conference in Canberra earlier in the year, and while it specifically looked at the Australian scene, I hope there will be enough messages here which are relevant to all of you. I've also, in deference to my homeland, attempted to leaven it with some New Zealand material, so bear with me. I think that maintaining the public's health in Australia and New Zealand requires a deft balancing act. The balancing of the overall well-being of the community against the individual's rights and freedoms. An exceedingly difficult undertaking, even at the best of times, because there is an intrinsic and basic conflict between the two. In normal circumstances, it's difficult. In times of epidemic crisis, it often becomes impossible. It's interesting, I think, that countries like Australia and presumably New Zealand still struggle with this basic dilemma of how societies committed to the supremacy of civil liberties and sensitive to discrimination reconcile the conflict between individual rights and the common good. Epidemics of infectious disease were a familiar and inescapable feature of life in Australia and New Zealand throughout the last two centuries, and a regular reminder of the insecurity of life and the ubiquitous presence of death and disease. Although such epidemics were usually short-lived and for the most part not great demographic crises, they nonetheless had tremendous impact and their effects were wide-ranging. I think looking back on the history of epidemics is important for a number of reasons. Firstly, while the demographic impact of such events may have been limited, their psychosocial impact was tremendous. They captured public attention and were responsible for great outpourings of fear, panic, and hysteria. Secondly, they became, in Australia and New Zealand, the prime cause of public health reform, particularly in the way they often focused attention on the biophysical and the human environment, particularly in Australian towns and cities, where they directed public attention to the unsanitary and impoverished living and working conditions of the poor. In this, plague and smallpox filled the role in Australia and New Zealand that cholera had done in England years before. Indeed, in New Zealand, the threat of plague in 1900 led to the establishment of the Department of Public Health. And in the 1918 pandemic of influenza in New Zealand led, as I'm sure most of you know, to the passing of the 1920 Health Act and the establishment of a new Ministry of Health, a remodelling of regional and district health infrastructure, the emergence of a division of Maori hygiene, and the state assuming for the first time the full responsibility for infectious diseases. Thirdly, epidemics and epidemic experience put to the test and challenged colonial, state, federal, local governments' comprehension and management of extreme natural events. And I think finally, they place in sharp perspective the internal workings of Australian and New Zealand society. And in particular, they strip away the veneer we erect about our lives, revealing us perhaps as we truly are, fearful about contagion, fearful about others and outsiders, fearful about threats from the outside, needing to find someone to blame, and certainly in Australia, inherently sceptical about the government's power to protect us. Perhaps it applies here. It's not easy indeed to obtain an overview of epidemics and pandemics in Australia over the last 200 years. For one thing, and here I pay deference to my homeland, for one thing, there remains no comprehensive and searching study of infectious disease and public health in Australia to compare with Maclean's classic study of public health in New Zealand, which is now over 40 years old. For another, the actual elastic, for want of a better term, definition of what constitutes an epidemic makes study difficult. For example, is a tiny outbreak of food poisoning in a very small boarding school an epidemic? On a cruise ship, perhaps, an epidemic. Further, in some cases, it's not the impact of the agent in terms of cases and deaths or the spatial or temporal frame of the epidemic that's important, so much as the public perception and reaction to the disease involved. SARS, bird flu, and the recent intense interest in a possible human pandemic of flu demonstrate this only too well, as smallpox and plague did last century. Then I think, particularly in the Australian context, one has to appreciate the vagaries of the various state government reporting structures about infectious disease and the surveillance systems, which, to my chagrin, produce tremendous inconsistencies in disease reporting. So that, for example, in 1940, when there was an extraordinary epidemic of rubella throughout most of Australia, producing between 30 and 40,000 cases, because rubella was not a notifiable disease, there is no official record of the epidemic at all. Finally, I suppose, many epidemics have low visibility because they either cause only mild illness, for which formal treatment is never sought, and thus largely go unnoticed and unreported. And perhaps I might add here, unless taken up by some zealous media reporter who wishes to highlight in their usual way for a national or local newspaper. Many of these sort of problems make my job as a historical demographer, historical epidemiologist, difficult in an attempt to reconstruct how societies behaved and how people reacted to the threat of epidemic crises. And I think I've always found it extraordinary how easily we're panicked by the threat of epidemic disease and how small a part knowledge of past epidemics plays in our historical memory. Australia and New Zealand are actually littered with major outbreaks of infectious disease and the threats of pandemics. In the past 200 or so years, Australia and New Zealand, for example, have been swept up in at least 12 pandemics, from the scarlet fever one that lasted a good proportion of the 19th century, from 1830 to 80, and influenza in 1836-38 in Australia, through, of course, to HIV/AIDS, probably in the 1980s and afterwards, as well as innumerable local epidemics. During the 19th century, Australia participated in at least three influenza pandemics, culminating in the pandemic of 1889-91. The last great pandemic of bubonic plague, which swept out of Asia in the late 19th century and which probably caused between 30 and 50 million deaths by the 1930s, claimed officially 535 lives in Australia, probably many more, between 1900 and 1922, and indeed 21 lives in New Zealand as well. The last pandemic of smallpox, variola minor, which affected the world between 1897 and 1940, and affected Australia between 1913 and 17, produced 3,000 cases alone in New South Wales, and also 2,000 plus cases in New Zealand. The influenza pandemic of 1918-19, which I'm sure you're all well familiar by now, given the publicity over the last year or so, produced, probably killed about 15,000 people in Australia. The official figures are severe underestimation, as well as 8,573 in New Zealand. And an area of my interest, what about the pandemic of encephalitis lethargica, which swept through the world in the post-World War I period up until the 1930s, and probably affected between 4 and 5 million people? There's no interest in this at all, apart from a couple of interesting books, non-technical. Possibly there were 5,000 cases of encephalitis lethargica in Australia and probably as many as 600 to 800 deaths. And from my perspective, most importantly, there still exists no searching analysis of the great epidemics of polio which swept through Australia and New Zealand in the first 50 years of the 20th century. And as I've said a moment ago, Australia and New Zealand continue to participate in the great pandemic of HIV/AIDS, which has swept the world since 1982. Now, in addition to all of this, Australia is in a particularly interesting situation because it's swept up in a whole variety of dengue outbreaks regularly. Some of these have been extraordinary epidemics. The outbreak, probably between 1897 and the late 1940s, produced some extraordinary scenes of infectious disease outbreaks in Australia stemming from dengue. The first three were really major epidemics. The epidemic of 1904-5, mainly in Queensland, produced about 220 deaths, but about 150,000 cases of dengue. But that pulls against the 1925-26 outbreak of dengue, which affected the whole eastern seaboard of Australia and perhaps produced 600,000 cases of dengue. Most of the small towns in Queensland and northern New South Wales, between 75 and 80% of the population had dengue in 1925-26. An extraordinary situation, yet there remains no searching discussion of it. And if another person in Australia tells me there were no dengue deaths in the 20th century, I think I'll strangle them. Dengue, of course, remains a significant health threat in parts of northern Queensland and possibly with climate change in parts of New South Wales. The mosquito vector Aedes aegypti is widespread over the eastern seaboard and there are regular outbreaks of dengue every couple of years in Townsville and parts of northern Queensland. A survey done, if I remember rightly, in the 1930s indicated that 75% of all school children in Queensland had been exposed to dengue. An interesting circumstance for the future. I'm interested in epidemics from a variety of perspectives. One is, like most disasters, they remain an acid test of human behaviour and offer a unique opportunity for the study of individual and group behaviour during times of extreme stress. I think they act as a magnifying glass, illuminating social and behavioural patterns that under more normal circumstances may well remain hidden. The way communities react to such crises tells us much about how the way societies function and are internally structured, and how our fellows in time and space viewed the world around them. One of the interesting things about epidemics, I think, is that public reaction, fear, hysteria, panic, call it what you will, is rarely related to the severity of illness or disease. The measles epidemic, which was a tremendous crisis in Australia in 1866-67, is a case in point. We'll talk about that in a moment. Possibly 80% of all children in New South Wales had measles in 1866-67, yet it evoked no public comment at all, not in the press, not among the medical profession. It was simply accepted as a rite de passage, something that all children should experience. And growing up in New Zealand in the 40s and 50s, I remember exactly that. Measles was something we all had. You got over it. You stayed home. Because we were all well-nourished living in this wonderful country, we all survived. And you just got on with life. And I'll have more to say about that in a moment. But if you compare that with the reaction that was engendered traditionally in Australia and New Zealand by smallpox and plague earlier, and latterly by HIV/AIDS, SARS and bird flu, then you get a very different picture indeed. Occasionally, epidemics in Australia attained the status of a major mortality or morbidity event. And indeed, in the context of small, isolated communities, and I guess this applies very much to New Zealand as well, the impact of an epidemic could be magnified out of all proportion to the number of cases and deaths. The best example I can think of is the polio outbreak in Tasmania in 1937-38, when there were more than 1,000 cases of polio in a total population of only 241,000. There were 640 cases to children aged under 10 years. That 1,000 cases represented a rate of 142.7 cases per 10,000 population, the highest recorded ever in a developed country. Epidemics of childhood diseases rank among the most important in Australia and New Zealand's history. The measles epidemic, which I mentioned a moment ago, of 1866-67, which affected Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia, claimed almost 12,000 lives. Possibly it claimed a lot in New Zealand as well, but there is no record. During this epidemic, it's possible that about 80% of children aged under 5 had measles in Sydney and in parts of New South Wales. The 1875-76 epidemic of scarlet fever produced more than 80,000 cases in Australia and possibly around about 8,000 child deaths. And interestingly enough, that epidemic arched over into New Zealand a year later, where it caused at least 331 European deaths, and probably, if you factored in Maori deaths, which are unrecorded, possibly between 600 and 700 deaths in total. It's very difficult to get a complete picture of the impact of epidemic disease prior to the 1950s in either country. What I've been able to reconstruct suggests that there are at least 19 occasions when epidemics approximated major mortality or morbidity crises. Most of those occurred in the 1868-1938 period. Some assumed considerable dimensions, as you can see on this overhead, evoked extraordinary public reaction, and many were instrumental, significantly, in producing public health reform. Now, in the brief time allotted, I want to comment upon a number of epidemics and pandemics which occurred between 1875 and the early part of the 20th century. All were traumatic events in Australia and to some extent New Zealand's social and epidemiological history. All were the instigators of important changes in surveillance, management of and response to epidemic crises. Now, my list is as important for what it leaves out as for what it includes. I'll make no comment about polio or the dengue or HIV/AIDS. Comment on these must await another stage when you invite me back in a year or so. Firstly, the scarlet fever outbreak of 1875-76 and a little bit later in New Zealand. This was the virulent tail or the end of a pandemic which really commenced in the 1830s and spread right through the next 60 or so years. It was the last severe episode of this disease in Australian history. And the epidemic affected almost all of Australia and was in many ways a turning point in the development of attitudes towards infectious disease. It was really the first epidemic in Australian history to excite public interest, official concern, and one of the first to produce a tentative search for causes and the medium of transmission. The epidemic probably produced, it's hard to know, but about 40, 50,000 cases, perhaps 8,000 deaths, and it resulted in a series of official reports which were concerned not only with the causes, as far as they could ascertain, and the prevalence of the disease and what treatment might be advanced, but also advanced some cautious measures for its management and control. Some of the suggested measures, like the isolation of the sick, banning children from homes where the disease had broken out from attending school, cleansing and disinfecting homes and public places, rubbish removal, concern for polluted water supplies and proper drainage, and the empowering of local boards of health to take the overall responsibility for the management of the outbreak and for home treatment of those suffering, would ultimately form the framework of more formalised public health responses over the next few decades, both in Australia and indeed also in New Zealand. There's a brief summary of the outbreak there and the points I've just been making. The second epidemic I want to look at is the smallpox outbreak in Sydney in 1881-82. This represents the first real major psychosocial crisis in Australian history and in 19th century. Although the actual number of cases and deaths were small, probably only 163 cases, 41 deaths, the outbreak evoked large-scale scenes of public fear, hysteria, and panic, and was the first example in Australia of the widespread use of traditional public health interventions to contain an infectious disease outbreak. These included case identification, isolation and formal quarantine, the enforced removal of cases and contacts, the closure of schools, widespread cleansing, fumigation and demolition of infected premises, as well as the compulsory vaccination for key health and other workers, inmates of government institutions and politicians, and the optional vaccination of contacts in the general public. The epidemic also gave rise to social conflicts in Australia, hitherto unseen. There was an extraordinary wave of anti-Chinese feeling, discrimination, boycotts and violence directed against the Chinese community throughout much of New South Wales, largely because they were thought to have somehow been involved in the actual arrival of the infection. It's probably the first example also of the politicisation of disease in Australian history, where New South Wales politicians used the outbreak to, and the fear engendered, to push a Chinese restriction bill through Parliament. And this is a motif that occurs throughout the history of infectious disease in both countries. The requirement to find someone to blame, the assignment of blame to somebody who is distinctively identifiable and usually an outsider. The epidemic also gave rise to a whole range of scapegoating and dobbing. The police files in New South Wales are full of letters of people complaining about their neighbours, a very un-Australian sort of thing to do, where they'll write to the police and say, "I haven't seen my neighbour for 3 days. I think he may have smallpox." The regrettable, and this happened again in the plague outbreak in 20 years' time, the regrettable thing about that is that many people were simply taken from their homes and forcibly incarcerated and quarantined, simply on the grounds of somebody dobbing them in from a neighbour. As I say, most Australians would deny that such behaviour is possible. The outbreak of influenza, which hit Australia in 1890-91 and New Zealand slightly later, was part of the pandemic that affected the world between 1889 and 1891. It was really the first time Australia and New Zealand have been swept up in a major pandemic of influenza. And in many ways, it ushered in a new epidemiological age. In Australia, it was the first pandemic with widespread effects and few families escaped its ravages. It arrived at a time when the medical community still clung tenaciously to miasmatic theories of disease causation, and when confronted by an infectious disease that affected a large proportion of the population, regardless of social class, and was often so mild as to avoid detection, the methods adopted to control diseases like smallpox, such as notification, isolation, formal quarantine, cleansing, fumigation, etc., could no longer practically be put into effect. Consequently, effort was directed towards public education, which encouraged people to avoid public crowds, gatherings, to stay home if ill, to avoid coughing and sneezing in public, sounds familiar, as well as to involve any demonstrative signs of infection in public. The pandemic was also the first to have a major impact on business and social life in Australia. During October and November in 1890, many schools were closed, government services cut, and many businesses pushed right to the edge of existence. And now something dear to my heart. I've been a student of plague in Australasia for 30 years. The epidemic of plague, which broke out in Sydney in 1900, was the last part of the last great pandemic of plague, which swept out of China in the 1890s, and whose effects lingered on into the 1940s. In terms of community disruption, human tragedy, suffering and panic is probably the greatest disaster in Australia's 19th century history. Although there were only 300 cases and 103 deaths in Sydney, there may well have been 500 or 600, the epidemic caused widespread social and economic dislocation, tremendous fear, hysteria and panic. And it was during this epidemic that the policies of case identification, isolation, removal and quarantine, cleansing and scavenging were applied with great vigour. In all of this, the authorities were helped by the fact that plague, like smallpox before it, fell mainly upon Sydney's working class areas, allowing the adoption of more draconian measures of containment than might otherwise have been the case. It's left us a wonderful record of exactly what went on. There's a wonderful file, fearing legal actions, they actually photographed every house in Sydney that had plague. Most people were forcibly removed, which gave view to some of the extraordinary scenes in Sydney. There were violent fights in the Rocks area of Sydney where people refused to leave their homes, where they were actually removed from their homes by police using long poles and breaking down their door. Probably 2,000 people were forcibly removed from their homes during the 1900 outbreak and incarcerated over the North Head quarantine station. Initially, there was no effort to discriminately to segregate cases from contacts, and you can imagine the sort of environment that this produced. Most areas in central Sydney were quarantined formally with barricades and a police guard. After this was done, a team, hundreds, in fact thousands, of cleansers and fumigators would work their way systematically through the homes and the neighbouring homes, cleaning, whitewashing everything, including people's clothes. Many people spent 6 to 8 months at the quarantine station before being allowed to actually return. Large areas of central Sydney were totally demolished during the 1900 plague, particularly Chinese. The Chinese were treated very harshly. They were simply incarcerated at North Head in a segregated area on the foreshore in tents away from the quarantine station. Proportionally, a much larger number of people were quarantined. While they were in quarantine, most of their homes and businesses were totally destroyed in Sydney. They bore the full brunt of people's fear reaction and the emotional surge of hysteria. It was an extraordinary episode in Australian history, really, and literally tens of thousands of people were swept up in it. It was also pioneering because Ashburton Thompson, the then chief medical officer, was one of the first in the world to formally identify the link between the rat, the flea, and the transmission of plague. And this gave rise to an extraordinary campaign of rat collecting in Sydney. People were given a capitation fee of sixpence for every rat they delivered, which, given the Australian nature of how they see life, people imported bush rats from all over New South Wales. And many people complained about having to share the public transport system with people with sacks of rats going to the incinerator. An interesting insight. At another level, a particular form of vaccine was available, Hafkin's vaccine, and it was made available to the public. Well, initially it was made available to the public. On the first day, something like 10,000 people stormed the Board of Health's offices, broke down the doors and the windows, smashed the building in an attempt to get vaccinated. After that, vaccine was withdrawn. It perhaps tells you something about the way people behave in times of severe crisis. It also brought forth extraordinary social conflicts, neighbour against neighbour. And again, the police records have extraordinary letters from people who'd lived next door to a neighbour for 30 years and actually dobbed them in, saying, he seems to be sneezing a lot, has he got plague? And literally 500 people, 600 people, maybe even more, were formally quarantined simply on the basis of suspicion raised by a friend or a neighbour. It perhaps tells you about something about how people are pushed to the edge at times of severe epidemic crisis. There are also other extraordinary social conflicts, doctor against doctor, local government against the state government, everybody against the Chinese. Citizens' vigilance committees were formed throughout Sydney, who formally went round and reported on insanitary conditions, but also people, and oversaw rat catching. The plague epidemic is important for a whole range of reasons, not the least of which is the pioneering work of Ashburton Thompson and the small team he had available in New South Wales, but also the equally important work of Mason in New Zealand. Ashburton Thompson's team produced pioneering maps of the distribution and spread of plague and the distribution of rats in Sydney. They also encouraged cooperation rather than confrontation as the hallmark of addressing the epidemic. And indeed, as I mentioned a moment ago, Ashburton Thompson was one of the first to appreciate the ecological nature of plague and the role played by rats and fleas in its transmission. In New Zealand, James Malcolm Mason, Sanitary Commissioner and then Chief Health Officer, pioneered a set of public health procedures during the fear of plague in 1900, governing the inspection, fumigation and surveillance of ships and passengers that was to become, 50 years later, standard international practice. Whoops, jumped that one. Right, jumping to smallpox in New South Wales and the Auckland province. As I mentioned earlier, the epidemic of smallpox, with variola minor, which broke out in Sydney in 1913 and actually persisted till 1917 in New South Wales, is important for a whole range of reasons. While a mild form of the disease, it represents the most significant Australian encounter with smallpox after the early years of settlement. There are probably about 3,000 cases of smallpox, including more than 2,000 in Sydney. And the epidemic is important because it was the first time in Australia the Commonwealth exercised its powers under the new Federal Quarantine Act and for the extraordinary reaction that that engendered in New South Wales. In early July, the Commonwealth invoked the Quarantine Act without even consulting the New South Wales government and declared an area within 15 kilometres of the Sydney GPO a formal quarantine area. Nobody could move in or out. At the same time, the Commonwealth urged New South Wales to introduce compulsory vaccination for all its citizens. All mail leaving Sydney was fumigated, land barriers were erected at all state barrier borders, and most interstate and overseas shipping bypassed Sydney. The quarantine produced an extraordinary uproar in Sydney among government, the business community, and the general public. All, and this is a long-standing motif in Australian history, all who strongly resented Commonwealth interference. A violent debate raged in Parliament. There were huge public meetings throughout 1913 and 14 between pro-vaccinators, anti-vaccinators, pro-state, anti- and pro-Commonwealth people. Unlike many other states in Australia, and to some extent New Zealand, New South Wales had always resisted compulsory vaccination of children against smallpox and was reluctant to pass legislation. On many occasions in the late 19th, early 20th century, smallpox legislation almost passed Parliament but never managed to do so. During this outbreak, from July to early November 1913, approximately 500,000 people sought vaccination against smallpox in New South Wales, 231,000 in Sydney alone. You can imagine the scenes of in the streets of people actually on 2 days in early July. There were riots outside the Sydney Town Hall where people were trying to get in to be vaccinated. It's an interesting insight into Australian history. Many employers in 1913 told their employees, you get vaccinated or you don't work here. Get out, vaccinated or leave. The New South Wales Labor Council was deluged with complaints of victimisation. The pandemic also affected New Zealand between 1913 and April 1914, when more than 2,000 Maoris and 116 Europeans living in North Auckland, the Waikato and the Bay of Plenty succumbed to smallpox. 55 Maoris died during the outbreak. It was a significant episode in New Zealand history. Moving on very quickly. I don't want to spend too much time on the influenza outbreak because it's received tremendous publicity, and my old friend Geoffrey Rice has rewritten a wonderful book on it anyway. But it, as you are all familiar, I'm sure, it stands as the greatest natural disaster in Australian and New Zealand history in many ways. In Australia and New Zealand, the pandemic was really a major demographic and social tragedy, affecting the lives of millions. In 6 months in 1919, more than 14,000 Australians died and more than 2 million had flu. In New Zealand, the pandemic was even more severe, as I'm sure you're all aware, over 8,500 deaths, and the overall death rate was 3 times the Australian death rate. The Maori death rate was 7 times the European death rate in Australia. And again, as I'm sure you were all familiar with, the most striking thing about the pandemic was the group of people it struck mostly. Mostly young, healthy adults aged between 25 and 40. The best way I can describe that is in 1919, 27% of Sydney's population were aged between 25 and 40, yet they contributed 50% of all the flu deaths. I'll come back to that point in a moment, I think. What I want to do now is draw out some challenges and lessons from these, which I think are as important today as you might think from the vagaries of a historical epidemiologist looking at the past. I believe we've got much to learn from the way Australia and New Zealand society responded to these earlier epidemic crises. I think they provide many insights into how authorities faced the threat of infectious disease and how the general public reacted. There are a whole range of issues here, and I'm only going to look at two, in fact. But the whole issues are related to cooperation between various levels of government, understanding and managing public reaction, confronting vested interests, issues of isolation and quarantine, and so on. Far too much. I'm going to look at just two, the first two. Ensuring cooperation, and you may think that's irrelevant to the New Zealand scene, but perhaps it's not. I think dealing with major epidemics and pandemics obviously calls for cooperation between the various levels of government, local, state, Commonwealth, whatever. Despite current confidence, such things, I believe, cannot be taken for granted. In fact, the history of response to epidemics in both countries is littered with examples of lack of cooperation, self-interest, ignorance, overreaction, and outright antagonisms. Early last century, smallpox and plague demonstrated in Australia how trade interests and interstate state Commonwealth rivalries intersected with matters of health and made the overall achievement and maintenance of the public's health a very difficult undertaking. For example, in Australia, the 1908 Quarantine Act clearly gave the Commonwealth powers of internal quarantine, but in 1909, the Federal Minister of Health assured the states, quote, that it was not the Commonwealth's intention to make use of the powers with regard to disease arising in any state. In 1913, when smallpox broke out, all that was swept aside. Cumston, the new director of Commonwealth Quarantine, unilaterally quarantined New South Wales and parts of Sydney. With respect to the influenza pandemic of 1919, despite a Commonwealth convened conference in 1918, when all the states and territories in Australia agreed, and there are messages here for what's happened recently, agreed to a 13-point plan to address a potential influenza outbreak, including things like the states agreeing to immediately notify the Commonwealth once cases became apparent, and agreeing that once a state was declared infected, there would be no movement across state borders. It was also agreed the Commonwealth would take overall responsibility for quarantine. Once influenza broke out, all that was swept aside. It broke out first in Victoria, and they refused to notify the Commonwealth government. It then spread to New South Wales. Many states were reluctant to declare any sort of outbreak, but once the outbreak was evident in New South Wales, it was every state for themselves. The agreement of 1918 was literally thrown out the window. Victoria threatened reprisals against New South Wales because New South Wales closed its borders. States set up their own border quarantine camps. Every state had a different system of detaining people. There were clashes with the Commonwealth over returning troops not being allowed to land in Queensland. Queensland took the Commonwealth to the High Court. Western Australia threatened to secede from the Commonwealth because they stopped the train. Tasmania did the same because there was quarantine on interstate traffic, maritime traffic, and so it went. And I argued recently in front of a Commonwealth committee that my experience in the past, one had to be a little bit sanguine about believing that everybody would cooperate in a healthy, happy way. They weren't interested. They believed that come the next influenza pandemic, we'd all cooperate and we'd all be very happy about it. There are lots of episodes. Again, in 1921, plague broke out in Queensland again. And the Queensland government refused to notify the Commonwealth government for 3 weeks because they feared a trade embargo, they feared borders being closed, they feared quarantine, and the upshot of that was the disease spread to New South Wales and lingered for a much longer period of time. The second point I want to make, and this is the last I'll make on this, is understanding public reaction and managing fear. I think epidemics are as much psychosocial events as they are epidemiological ones. And I think, regrettably, governments in Australia and New Zealand don't always recognise this. I think one of the consistent themes in the history of epidemics in Australia and New Zealand is the failure to appreciate the dissonance that exists between how experts and how ordinary people perceive risk, infection, and contagion. As you well know, risk to experts is a definable, measurable phenomenon. But risk to the general public is not related to empirical evidence at all, but more shaped by personal attitudes and the way we view the world around us. It's a social phenomenon, socially constructed, largely intuitive, and certainly emotional. And I don't think we fully understand the nature of emotional contagion during times of epidemic crisis. Witness, for example, how the Maori population regarded flu in 1918. Their response was shaped by deep-seated religious and cultural beliefs about disease and the supernatural, which produced a certain fatalism in the face of crisis, which European medicos could not understand at the time. I think it's also true that people harbour deep-seated fears about contagion, which I think are a mix of rational and irrational fears about exposure, infection, and indeed outsiders being somehow responsible. And fear, I think, is an emotion that's highly communicable. And as I said a moment ago, we do not really fully understand the mechanisms of its transmission. Now, it's true that governments often see fear as a sort of social vaccine, something which encourages responsible coping mechanisms. And that's true. But I also think it doesn't take much, and usually the media have a role to play in this, to tip it into something very different, like hysteria and panic and the search for someone to blame. I think, and I'll conclude, in the final analysis, the study of the impact, diffusion, and effects of past epidemics and pandemics is a rewarding experience from a range of points of view. In the first place, I believe there is a need for retrospective studies of the behaviour of epidemics in different populations exposed to a variety of healthcare circumstances. In the second, close observation of the way people and communities respond during crises can reveal much about social attitudes, patterns of activity and interaction, as well as underlying tensions, conflicts, and antagonisms. Thirdly, the experience of such outbreaks may result in significant changes in human values, attitudes, and behaviour, and indeed may lead, as it has in the past, to important changes in public health. And finally, I think if we don't learn from the past, if we simply dismiss what happened as part of an earlier, less scientific age, then we run the risk of repeating the mistakes made. Let Ashburton Thompson, possibly the greatest of Australia's public health practitioners, have the last word. Writing in 1899, he said, "The brilliancy of modern discoveries blinds incautious eyes to old truths and often endangers sound practice." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Curson. I think we're all going to be working very hard on those neighbourly relations over the next few years to make sure we don't get dobbed in like some of the individuals obviously did in the last century. I would like to offer out to the audience now, anyone who would like to ask Professor Curson a question, could you please just put your hand up and wait for one of the microphones, please, to get to you so that the audience listening in will also be able to hear what you're saying.
Is there any evidence that people's behaviour changes over history? So you've talked about different stimuli, but is there any reason to think the modern person will behave differently from the person in the 1900s?
I'd like personally to think so. Looking back at the history of epidemic encounters or how people behave with infectious disease, I'm inclined to say possibly not. I mean, the sort of devil in the cauldrons is really the role of the media plays in some ways these days. I mean, there's no doubt that the media have an important role in health to perhaps raise issues. But certainly if you look back more recently over the SARS and the bird flu outbreaks, the role of the media was extraordinary, really, and heightened public hysteria and fear and tension. And, I mean, the media never reflects on the impact of what it writes on the people who read it. The media's job is simply to sell newspapers or to get people to watch TV. And thus they tend to highlight the spectacular, the sensational and whatever. And to what in some ways that sort of replaced the 19th, early 20th century human behaviour reaction to infectious disease. Now we've got somebody who tends to orchestrate public response in some ways. There have been, of course, changes. I'm belittling the sort of role of social change and education and whatever. Most of the epidemics I've been talking about, the majority of the people never read a newspaper, or some of them couldn't read anyway. They were affected by people around them. And I suspect that's true. During the SARS epidemic, a number of my colleagues when I was at Macquarie University were actually starting to stockpile masks and stockpile bottles of water and it has an effect on people around. I mean, if people around you are stockpiling food and masks and talking about it all the time, then you're swept up in a sense. I managed to avoid it, and SARS. So in some ways we're still moved by the behaviour, the sort of environment around us and how we see it in some ways. I'm not giving you a really definitive answer, but I as a sort of historical demographer, committed to the past, I'd personally probably say very little change.
I don't think we're going to change human nature, basically, except by perhaps education, maybe, which is a very slow process. But in the process of the education, what happens in a panic situation is people either ignore it or they take things to great extremes, which overall has the diverts energy from what can be done to what, so that almost people panic and they overreact instead of starting a bit earlier on and working from the preventative aspects of it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a strong view that a certain amount of fear and panic is a good thing, that it provides people to reassess prevention and coping measures, and there's a whole field of risk communication in the United States which argues this, that responsible fear provides an assessment of resources and coping strategies. The problem is defining what responsible fear is and how it's manipulated in our society. I mean, as I said a moment ago, the media have an important role in health advocacy. I'll never deny it. But the media do remain responsible for many of our attitudes and how we view the world today. And a lot of it is irresponsible, I think, reporting, sensational, and tends to certainly influences the people around me. I mean, they tend to be influenced by, I'm thinking back to the bird flu and the SARS, the extraordinary public media coverage. Some years ago, we did a survey of the relationship between the media's coverage of bird flu and the demand for scripts of Relenza and Tamiflu. And in 1 month, there were 800 media mentions, major articles in Australian newspapers on bird flu, many of them taking up whole pages. And within a few weeks, there was an extraordinary demand for scripts of Tamiflu in Australia and bird flu and Relenza, none of which could be met because the pharmacies didn't have any, but they had long waiting lists. And it was a good example of how people's behaviour was in some ways heightened by the media coverage of an epidemic event. Now, you might argue that that was a good thing. People were beginning to contemplate how they might protect themselves and what they might do in such a circumstance. The other thing I've often argued with the Australian government is that in the final analysis, Australians, and I don't know enough about it, I've been away too long from New Zealand, have a tremendous scepticism about the government's role of protecting them and during any sort of epidemic crisis. Most Australians do not believe that the government would protect them if a pandemic of influenza came about, whether it's the state or Commonwealth government. People then sort of fall back on their own family resources and the family responsibility. There's been tremendous, as you're well aware, I'm sure, tremendous attention given to producing pandemic plans for the next influenza pandemic, if and when it comes. But I still remain personally sceptical that people honestly believe that the government will protect them. In Australia, that's particularly the case because getting access to a vaccine, if they ever produce one, or even access to Tamiflu is very difficult. So I guess fear is important as a precautionary measure, but the tipping point into something else, and often the media's role in it, is perhaps an uncertainty in all of this.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to close there. We're coming to the end of our teleclass broadcast time. In closing, I'd like to thank Professor Curzon very much for his contribution to the South Pacific Weather Training teleclass series. You've given us all much food for thought, so thank you. Thank you once again to Johnson & Johnson for their generous sponsorship of this session. That's much appreciated. And, of course, thank you to Simon and Cameron, his team, for the technical support in enabling this session to take forward. You've been fantastic. There are two remaining South Pacific teleclasses for this year, one next week, and also later in the year in October. So any of you who'd like to join us for those, then details can be found on the Weather Training website. I do hope you'll be able to join us later in the series, but until then, from all of us here in Wellington, thank you very much for listening in, and goodbye for now.